Hello, and welcome to episode 3.4, the October 25th, 2023 Spooktacular Edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat, the podcast that covers the arts in Northern Chautauqua County, sponsored by the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. My name is Tom Laughlin, and I'm your host as we bring you news and information about arts events at the Opera House and around the region, including interviews with artists and creators across the county. I'm sure, like me, many of you have noticed how there are more and more outdoor Halloween decorations outside people's houses. The trend seems to be growing, and I used to wonder why people went through all the trouble of decorating their houses for both Halloween and the winter holiday season. And then it occurred to me. It must have to do with the human instinct to ward off the darkness. At this time of year, it gets dark around 6 o'clock, and come the return of standard time, it will be dark around 5 o'clock. I sense there's a strong connection between the increasing darkness and the urge to light up the night with decorations for the late fall season. Come the winter solstice in the new year, the light begins to return, and the illuminating decorations are returned to storage. It may be the 21st century, but it seems like age-old instincts continue to find ways to manifest themselves, keeping the darkness at bay. And speaking of dark, the Metropolitan Opera has made the unusual choice of opening its 2023-24 season with Dead Man Walking, a modern opera based on the memoir by Sister Helen Prejean. I called upon the expertise of Dr. Robert Strauss of the School of Music to discuss this unusual season opening choice by the Met. There is one guest that I really enjoy having. He was one of my earliest guests ever when this podcast started, and I'm so appreciative of the fact that he's always willing to come on time and time again to talk about the Live at the Met Opera series at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House, and that is Dr. Robert Strauss. Dr. Strauss is a senior lecturer on the voice faculty at the School of Music at SUNY Fredonia, and he's working with Buffalo Opera Unlimited these days, and staying active. So, Rob, welcome once again, and thank you, as always, for being here.
Well, thanks so much for asking me.
You bet. So we're going to talk about Dead Man Walking, which is the first Live at the Met series coming up at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. And this is a really unique event in many, many different ways. And I want to spend a little time talking about that, because it's for the Metropolitan Opera. This is their premier production of their 2023-24 season. And it's unusual for them to take this kind of production. What is it that's so unusual about it?
Well, I think it's unusual in a lot of different ways. The story is really dark. The cast is really small. It's a very intimate show in a lot of ways. And you know, often we think of opera as being a spectacle and being over the top and huge casts and elephants crossing the stage. And so it's interesting, not only, you know, there's been a shift in the kinds of productions that the Met has been doing in the last several years, and we've talked about that, but that this is the premiere. This is the first one that they're not starting with something, you know, here's your grandmother's Met production, and then we'll move on to the things that are fringe. It's sort of like, you know, we talk about theater companies, they have to do Sound of Music to bring in the money so that they can fund, you know, Songs for a New World, so that they can do the things that maybe, you know, the performers really dig or really get into. But that audiences, it's a more fringe event. So I think it's fascinating.
Yeah, I find it fascinating, too. Now, interesting thing about Dead Man Walking is that it saw its premiere in 2000 at the San Francisco Opera, and it is the most produced so-called modern opera of the last 20 years in the repertoire for opera companies, you know, worldwide. If you wanted to do a contemporary opera, a lot of people pick Dead Man Walking. So in a way, it's unusual because it's intimate and small. But in a way, it's also like, let's pick the most popular opera that, you know, we can find in the 21st century.
In reading about this production, I was shocked to learn, to discover, to remember, maybe, that Dead Man Walking hasn't been done at the Met, because it has been, I think 2000 is what we said, is when it originally premiered. And I remember it being a really, really big deal, and continued to be a really, really big deal. I think, okay, so it's got a smaller cast, so it doesn't maybe cost as much to produce. Maybe the sets don't cost as much, so that could figure in. But I mean, with a story, or well, it's a real story, but with the words by Terrence McNally and the music by Jake Heggie, I mean, those are two, I mean, Terrence McNally, superstar, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And certainly Jake Heggie, I don't want to reveal my age. I still consider him to be up and coming, even though, again, he was up and coming 25 years ago and now is an established, but incredible and well-respected composer. So I think that figures in as well to why it gets done so much. And again, a little bit my shock that the Met hadn't done it yet.
Well, it seems that, you know, I was talking a little bit about this just at the end of last season, too, that the Met really has found itself after the Black Lives Matter, the COVID-19 pandemic, and the need for inclusion, diversity, and so on and so forth, that it's really making a very strong pivot to try and make itself a little more relevant to issues in you know, the 21st century. So rather than just be this big thing that, you know, constantly puts on bel canto operas, they want to be more contemporary. They want to be more attached to and find, in fact, audience members who are a little bit younger and want more contemporary stuff. And they're really making a big pivot to do that this year. Almost the entire first half of the season, up until the holiday season, are newer works written within the last 40 years.
Well, I think that's great. I think you think it's great, too.
I do, actually. Yes, I do.
But as we know, a part of that has to be the arts are expensive. They can be expensive. And so they need to make decisions that will get people in the door. And so what's exciting about this, I think, is more that these contemporary stories, these thought-provoking, dark, complicated stories are of interest to audiences. They will put forth money. And so maybe a moment ago, not to disrespect my grandmother's opera, but maybe, you know, maybe it's no longer my great-grandmother's opera, because may she rest in peace, she's not going to the opera anymore nor giving money. So, you know, the audiences, I think post-pandemic also, we found that audiences are a little bit choosier about what they'll leave the house to do. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I think it's exciting that the audiences want to find things that to them are relevant, that are going to make them think, that are going to continue conversations, as you say, Black Lives Matter, Me Too, stories about LGBTQI plus individuals, just marginalized communities, and having conversations about that so that we can hopefully better ourselves as people. And kudos to the Met for I think figuring it out, figuring out what on it, so that they don't have to cut back, pare back.
I really hope it's successful for them, because, you know, I mean, they have a $300 million operating budget, so, you know, they might be too big to fail, but we have to see how this works out for them. And I hope it works out well. I mean, it is exciting to me. Now let's talk a little bit about the opera itself, Dead Man Walking. It is a very, very famous story, and it was taken off a book written in 1995 by a woman by the name of Sister Helen Prejean. And she was a nun, a Catholic nun, and found herself ministering to two death row inmates in Louisiana, and getting them through to their actual execution and sentence. And through that experience, she became an activist for the elimination of capital punishment, and remains so to this day. She's 84 years old now. But she wrote a book called Dead Man Walking. That was the title of her book. And in it, she really talked about her experience working with these two people. And it caught on a lot. There was a movie made. Susan Sarandon and Sean Penn starred as Sister Prejean and Roche. It became obviously a play and then an opera. Its background is really pretty intense. And perhaps I can just ask you to talk a little bit about just the opera part of it. Jake Heggie and Terrence McNally, obviously, as the composer and librettist.
Sure. Well, I'll do my best. I mean, I mentioned Jack Heggie already, and I've had the pleasure of meeting him, and he is
really
yes. He's actually been to Fredonia and done some master classes, but I met him before that. I was conducting a work of his, and he came through town where I was, and I just sort of, as we do, it's like, hey, can I meet you? So we had coffee one day.
Wow.
And we talked about, you know, his life and political things and his piece. And he's so sweet. He's so down to earth, humble. And so it's interesting that this piece, this complicated piece about, I don't want to say a horrible human being, but, you know, a person who is on death row may not be a stellar person. And, you know, having to minister, it's really dark. It's really dark. It's really heavy. It's really horrible. And you know, one of the things that I know about Jake Heggie and his music that I think is interesting throughout is that he is a classical composer. He is classically trained, but he all the time draws from more contemporary styles of music, whether that be jazz, whether that be not exactly pop music, but more popular styles of music to infuse with the particular characters, you know, so that it shows who they are and helps the audience to relate to them, because their music has a certain quality and it helps with the characterization.
Yeah, the music, I've listened obviously to a couple of clips from the Met Opera YouTube, and it's just got the score at certain points is just very, it soars, you know. I mean, it really takes off and you know, quite the vehicle for you know, a superstar mezzo like Joyce DiDonato.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's interesting too. It's not what you brought up. So if I veer off course too much, just give me the high sign. But I mean, it is. So here I am a tenor and talking about how much I like the piece. The Prejean is a mezzo and Desroche is a baritone. So they're both lower voices than maybe we would see in you know, a La Bohème with the soaring soprano and the lovers. And I think that contributes to the, you know, the aural quality of it. They still sing high notes, but it's a different quality, different colors to them. And mm-hmm. I think gives a certain depth or difference for the audiences to relate to them again. And so, and
yeah,
Christy Donato.
Yeah, the voices, Ryan McKinney's voice is a very, very deep, rich baritone. And then, you know, Joyce DiDonato is famous as if not the most famous mezzo right now singing. And the two
For
of
sure.
them combined have that, you know, like you said, I don't want to say dark, but it has an intensity to it that you don't quite get when you're listening to lyric, sopranos and tenors.
Yeah, it's sort of acoustical properties of those frequencies that they're singing and the volume of those frequencies. I'm going to nerd out in a minute, so I'll stop talking about that. But I think it does afford very specific colors, again, with which both the composer and the performers, the composer played with, I suppose, and the performers play with, at their disposal to tell the story and to develop these characters.
Yes. And you know, I'm going to nerd out on Terrence McNally because he's like, you know, a god in the world of theatrical playwriting. He's one of the best playwrights we've had in the 20th, 21st century. Passed away in 2020 because of COVID-19, but a groundbreaker in so many areas. And one of the funny things is as I was moving through my career as a theater artist, you know, I knew all of Terrence McNally's works. I wish I had been in one. his works, he's a librettist for this, and he worked with Jake Heggie to create the libretto. And it's magnificent stuff. He's so good. And the funny thing is that I don't think of him as an opera librettist. And yet at the same time, he's got quite a career. And so many people who are familiar with contemporary opera say, Terrence McNally, oh, of course, he's an opera librettist. They don't even know he's a playwright.
Oh, isn't it? Well, that's a shame. We need to educate them. But again, just a master wordsmith. And again, it's about the way that he uses words for the characterization. We understand these people because of how brilliant he was at constructing the words together to tell us who they were.
It's such an interesting piece in that regard. And I do want to let the audience know that this is not a piece that takes a political position on capital punishment. That's a thing that I think is very important to understand. It talks about the journey of these people through this process.
Right. It doesn't preach.
Yes.
As far as that goes, it starts conversations, but it doesn't tell you what to think. It just presents these differing points of view within the story. I agree.
Yes, I think that's important to understand.
Yeah,
I think there are some nice touches in this opera. The original sister Helen Prejean was Susan Graham. She created the role, and she comes back as the mother of Joseph Desrochers, Mrs. Desrochers, to sing that particular little role. I think that's a nice touch.
It's wonderful. It's great that they did that. However, that came to pass. Marvelous.
Yes,
marvelous. She was incredible in the role.
I also read the review in the New York Times about it, and I guess Sister Prejean at 84 was in the opening night audience as well.
Oh, so wonderful.
So that's wonderful too. But I think audiences ought to be aware a little bit that, you know, the opera does have some controversial moments in it. There is some discussion of rape and murder, and at the end, I believe the final scene where Desrochers is in fact executed is a little bit shocking.
Yeah.
I won't give it away, but
all I'll say is pay attention to the trigger warnings.
I'm actually going to read the warning that the Met put out so that people right. understand that. I'm sure it is on the website for the Opera House, but
of course it is.
Things for people to be aware of. And sure. Well, it's going to make for an interesting viewing at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House when Dead Man Walking comes with our upcoming Live at the Met. So, Rob, as always, thank you for being on the show, for giving me your time. I do appreciate it very much. Good luck with whatever it is you happen to be involved in.
Thank you. Parpignol in La Boheme.
Parpignol in La Boheme.
Okay. I say it's the second biggest tenor role in the show because it is.
I wish I was directing it. That's all I can say, because that's one of my favorites. But
it's great. It's really great.
It really is great. And so good luck with that. And
thank you.
We'll probably be talking to you again, no doubt.
Great. Thank you so much.
Second hand sweeps up to midnight. Click buzzware. Joseph Desrochers is a dead man. Dead man walking. Dead man walking. August 4th. You hear me? You hear me?
Dead Man Walking will be presented at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House as part of its Live at the Met series on Saturday, October 28th, 2023, at 1 p.m. Tickets are $20 for adults, $18 for Opera House members, and $10 for students. Call the box office at 716-679-1891 for more information, or you can purchase tickets online by going to www.fredopera.org/tickets. Live at the Met is underwritten with the generous support of Daniel S. Kaufman and Timothy W. Beaver. The Metropolitan Opera House has issued this content advisory. Dead Man Walking contains a depiction of a rape and murder, as well as other adult themes and strong language. The Art and Architecture series kicks off its initial offering with a presentation from Seventh Art Productions entitled Klimt and the Kiss. This documentary film centers around the most famous work of Viennese painter Gustav Klimt, who painted The Kiss in 1908 and was part of the Art Nouveau movement that swept Vienna at the turn of the 20th century. I called upon painter and distinguished professor emeritus Alberto Rey to give us a deeper insight into Klimt and the Art Nouveau movement. Once again, I am joined by distinguished professor of art emeritus, Mr. Alberto Rey. He is here to talk about the upcoming art and architecture film, Klimt and the Kiss, which is coming to the 1891 Fredonia Opera House on Saturday, November 4th at 1 p.m. Alberto, welcome as always.
Thank you, Tom. It's always a pleasure. I'm looking forward to talking about Gustav a little bit.
Yeah. So why don't we just dive right into it then?
Sure.
Gustav Klimt, Art Nouveau, Vienna Secession. These are all the terms I think the people who come to this film are going to hear as they watch and listen to the film. So let's get a little background on all of that kind of history. Who was Gustav Klimt? What is the Art Nouveau movement and the specificity of the Vienna Secession?
So I think, as with all artists we've talked about in the past, I think it's everything that happens in an artist's career is reflective of many factors. I think for him, he was one of seven children. His mother was a musician who could never continue with her career because she was taking care of those seven kids. His father was a gold engraver, and he actually taught Gustav and his brother so that they were able to get a scholarship to the School of Art when they were 14. And the school was a 7-year program. So if you look at his drawings when he was young, his work was just unbelievable. It was just almost photographic in detail and sophistication and just incredible. And so him and his brother, they started this company. It was called the Art Group, and they decided to do murals. There was a lot of affluence happening in Vienna. There was a lot of building. A lot of large buildings were made, government and private homes, and everybody wanted some kind of mural. So they started this company. And by the time he was 26, that group got this major award from the government. It was a Golden Medal of Merit because of the quality of their work. And it was fairly traditional, fairly realistic, fairly academic. And then society in Vienna started to change. Things became a little bit more rebellious. You had Sigmund Freud, you had Mahler, you had Wagner with his changing the standards of architecture. Social norms were questioned, and so he became part of this Vienna secession movement that questioned traditional approaches to painting and the arts, and the movement tried to encourage this type of experimental approach to art, and it included a lot of different factors. Japanese prints were very popular. Art Nouveau became kind of an interesting development in architecture and design, and was incorporated into painting, so that the paintings, instead of being this kind of traditional three-dimensional images, started to become flat. So you had these realistic figurative works, but the backgrounds and the clothing that the people were wearing, instead of being three-dimensional folds, became flat patterns and became very decorative, again kind of reflecting what was happening with Art Nouveau. And it was very, very different than anything that had happened before. And it became really frowned upon by academics and traditionalists, but it became a very exciting period. This is also right after the Impressionists. So a lot of what was happening with Impressionists started to be incorporated into this movement as well. And so there's kind of a building, kind of like a perfect storm of a lot of these movements. And in the United States, it was the gay 90s, 1890s. So it was happening around Western civilization. And it was a pretty important way of looking at the world.
Well, one of the things that I noticed in looking particularly at Klimt's work, but trying to get a handle myself on the Art Nouveau movement, was when I look at the difference between the painting styles, let's say, of the, you know, the mid-19th century, 1850s and 60s, and then all of a sudden you see these works that are colorful, that are segmented into different places. Like within the image, you've got three or four different segments of places to look at. The human models are not realistic at all. The lines are much more, they seem much more naturalistic. And there's all kinds of influences now coming up. I mean, I do see influences in the Impressions. I see a little bit of Van Gogh in some of Klimt's work. I see Japanese that you were mentioning about. The shift seems to be rather radical. I mean, it's sharp.
Yeah. And I think he was even pushing it even further. I think in time, he didn't think that movement was even severe enough. He started another movement, kind of like a subsection of it. It was actually called Klimt Movement, or the Klimt Group, which was even more experimental. This is also the time that his father and his brother passed away, and so his work became much more personal, much more experimental. That mural group went away, and his work started to really become very different. A lot of nudes, a lot of floating figures, kind of floating through time. There's another movement called Symbolism Movement that used a lot of figurative work, but not in a traditional sense. They were kind of floating in these compositions, and that was not popular. You're talking about a time in history where people were wearing, I mean, this is a typical bathing suit. You had a collar, long sleeve shirt, or for women, long sleeve shirts, pants, and then a dress over the pants. This is as risque as you could get on a beach. And here you have these monumental paintings, nude paintings of female figures and male figures floating, kind of interacting with each other. And then you have these abstract, I mean, imagine coming up with abstract shapes and compositions in the 1890s. I mean, that's just amazing. And the paintings that he was doing, I mean, you could exhibit them right now and they would be revered. It was just that far ahead of its time. It's amazing.
Gained a reputation, as you say, for his paintings that really depicted intimacy, love, sexuality, stuff like that. And this particular painting that the film is going to focus on, The Kiss, is one of his most famous in regards to that. A lot of his work revolves around that. Can you talk a little bit about the Kiss as a particular painting in and of itself, and how it expresses that part of Klimt's artistry?
Yeah, one of the things is that The Kiss has been, that image, that idea has been produced for generations before. And this was his iteration of that composition, of that subject matter. And his, you know, he was doing a lot of work that revolved around themes in life, you know, from life to relationships, to love, to sex, to death. And that's what his work was about. One of the things that's interesting about this painting is that he was influenced not only by his father, who was a goldsmith, more or less, very knowledgeable about gold, but he was influenced by Byzantine gold mosaics that he visited, and you can see that in the images of the composition of the clothing. There's also eight different types of gold used in the painting. So they were gold leaf, but all like eight different variations of that, and also platinum. And platinum was even more expensive than gold. So you're talking about using gold, which, to this day, you'll be able to see how it looked then. It doesn't change much over time, and platinum even less so. And then you had these very textured patterns. For the male, you have these square kind of geometric forms, and for the woman in the piece, it's this kind of circular, kind of much more organic. I think at the time it was also risque because people thought that the figures were nude underneath. There was no indication of any clothing, so there was a kind of the perception that he was two figures that were nude underneath this clothing. And then that how the figures were portrayed, the man was looking away, the woman is looking towards the viewer. She's kind of has a pale kind of facial features, which is reflective of Japanese artwork and prints. And then the background is this, it's layers of gold with oil stain and then flecks of gold on top of that. So it's a very layered surface. But if you look at the faces, if you look at the figures, they're very flat. They're almost all washes. There's a very little texture. It's very loosely done. The line is again reflective of the Japanese prints, but the clothing that they're wearing, that's the most textured elements of the painting. And it's very different than anything done before. That flatness, that pattern, and then the figures that are three-dimensional is unlike anything that had been done before that. And then one of the things that I find fascinating is just the hands. If you look at the hands, how sensitive the hands of the woman is, and how, they're just kind of curved, they're kind of thin, they're kind of almost a little frail, they're bent. And then the males are straight. They're just like almost a little rough. They're not sensitive as compared to the woman. The male is dark, almost lost in the background, but the lightness of the features of the woman and the sensitivity in her hands is quite striking. And then even if you look at the feet, how the toes are curled up, like that's, like she's being kind of emotionally drawn to the figure, is all very subtle, but just beautifully done.
So I understand that after Klimt died during World War II, there was this interesting story about how some of his paintings got destroyed, kind of a little bit sad, a loss to art history. What did you hear about that?
Well, it was, it's really fascinating and sad in that, I was doing some research for this, and the most beautiful paintings I think he ever did was for the University of Vienna, and also the most controversial. It was just phenomenal work, amazing. And the only images left are black and white images that were taken of it. And the reason there's only black and white images was because the Nazis during the war were collecting all this work, or stealing work from galleries and collectors, and putting them in this castle. And the last day of the war, after they had surrendered, the very last day that evening, they set that castle on fire, and it burned for days, and everything in it, all the artwork was destroyed, including 15 of Klimt's most, I think, some of his best work is lost forever.
That's a shame. It's a it's a sad story to hear in terms of art history, but that's the nature of war.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Well, Alberto, thank you so much for all the insights. I think that really gives the listeners going to have a good insight into what they're going to see when they come to take a look at this particular film, Climpton the Kiss. That's tremendous information. Thank you. What's new with you? What do you got going on?
I still have that paint, that exhibition up at Castellani Museum. That's going to be up until March. It's been up for 10 months. It's a pretty extensive installation with a huge wall mural. So if you're in the Buffalo area or Niagara Falls, it's about 5 minutes from Niagara Falls. So if you are in that area, I'd recommend checking it out. And there's also three, or I think there's four, five other galleries. So if you don't like my work, there's other work you look at too.
Who could not like your work, helper? It'll come on, be real.
Exactly.
It's very, very good stuff. Very fascinating. Okay, well, listen, thanks again, as always, Alberto. Really appreciate it. Your wisdom is always something that I think excites me and also can get the audience really ready to take this film and watch it at another level. So we'll be talking to you again, I'm sure, when we get another one. Thanks as always, and good luck. Enjoy the rest of the fall.
Thank you, Tom. It's always a pleasure.
Klimt and the Kiss will be presented at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House on Saturday, November 4th at 1 p.m. Tickets are $15 for adults and $10 for students. Call the box office for tickets at 716-679-1891 or purchase online at www.fredopera.org/tickets. Don't miss this stunning and beautiful documentary into one of the world's most significant works of art. Here is the arts calendar for the next 2 weeks, October 26th through November 7th. At the 1891 Fredonia Opera House, the Ecstasis Duo Student Recitals will take place on Thursday, October 26th at 5:30 p.m. This is a wonderful pre-dinner musical event featuring student performers from the studios of the Ecstasis Duo, Natasha Farney and Eliran Avdi. The event is free, but donations are always gratefully accepted. Also coming up at the Opera House is a screening of the musical Titanic, the musical. Written by Maury Yeaston and Peter Stone, this 1997 musical won 5 Tony Awards, including the Tony Award for Best Musical. This filmed version features the London production cast celebrating the 10th anniversary of the musical. Tickets are $15 for adults and $10 for students, available through the Opera House box office. The SUNY Fredonia School of Music will present the following events in the next 2 weeks. All events will take place in the Rausch Recital Hall on the SUNY Fredonia campus, and all of them are free and open to the public. The Fredonia Choral Showcase will perform on Sunday, October 29th at 4 p.m. The Brass Chamber Ensembles and Brass Choir will perform on Monday, October 30th at 8 p.m. The Fredonia Chamber Orchestra will perform on Wednesday, November 1st at 8 p.m. Guest artist Glenn Einschlag will give a bassoon recital on Thursday, November 2nd at 8 p.m. The World Music for Mallet Instruments will perform on Friday, November 3rd at 8 p.m. The Sorel Piano Fellows will give a concert on Saturday, November 4th from 9 a.m. until 5 p.m. And that will be followed by the 8th Annual Claudette Sorel Piano Competition on Sunday, November 5th, from 12 p.m. until 5:30 p.m. The African Drumming Ensemble will perform on Sunday, November 5th, at 8 p.m. And finally, the Percussion Ensembles will perform on Monday, November 6th, at 8 p.m. Remember, if you have an arts event coming up and would like to get it mentioned on the arts calendar, please send us an email at operahouse@fredopera.org or call the box office at 716-679-1891 with your information. If you enjoy a circus atmosphere, vaudeville, madcap mayhem, clowning, slapstick, and superb juggling, then you are going to love the upcoming show at the Rockefeller Arts Center. Mr. Kreitz and Woodhead, Sons of Vaudeville and Masters of Mayhem, will be performing in the Marvel Theater at SUNY Fredonia with two shows, one at 2 p.m. and another at 7 p.m. on Saturday, November 4th, 2023. I had the opportunity to speak with Woody Keppel, also known as Mr. Woodhead, about this upcoming show and his life and experience as a modern vaudevillian. Joining me now is a man who I think personally has had quite a fascinating career in vaudeville entertainment and show business. His name is Woody Keppel, and he'll be coming to the Rockefeller Arts Center and doing two shows on Saturday, November 4th, one at 2 o'clock and one at 7 o'clock. And this show is for people from 5 to 95. So if you're in that age range, this show's going to be for you. Woody, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Tom. Really delighted to be here and looking so forward to coming back to the Marvel Theater.
Yes. Now, I understand this is your third time coming, but it's the first time we've had a chance to talk to you and get some of your background. So I think I'm going to just kind of start with a little overview of how you got into the business in terms of, the kinds of things that you do, your career. Give us a little bit of back. It's kind of a sketch bio of yourself.
I grew up in Richmond, Virginia, and my mom was, when she was young, having children, was a children's theater director. So we would put on productions of South Pacific. I mean, all these great Broadway shows, musicals in our basement. And I also, because of my mom, I was able to be one of the darling kids in Peter Pan. I got to fly in one of our old vaudeville houses, as like a six-year-old. And it was a Broadway touring company of Peter Pan. And it was like, I just knew early on that's what I wanted to do. Going through adolescence, the school I went to didn't offer any of that. It was football, which I loved up until about the ninth grade. And I was too small to play football. And I got my bell rung, by this big guy, and I had enough of football. Then I tried golf, and I was always into physical things. So when I was able to discover theater and athletics all sort of rolled into one as a comedic character, a comic clown, a theater clown, when I discovered that, I knew that's what I wanted to do. It was just a great way of expression. And as a kid, my dad sort of weaned us on Laurel and Hardy and Charlie Chaplin and Marx Brothers. And this stuff was on TV, or we go to the movie theater in Richmond and watch the occasional, films that would come through. And it was vaudeville. My grandmother was a vaudevillian. So vaudeville's in my blood. And once I got amongst my tribe, the first clown camp I went to, there was no looking back. This is what I'm going to do. So it's been fun. I love a lot of my mileage has been with the character Woodhead, and he's my alter ego, and Woodhead has taken me all over the world, and it's given me this great course in therapy, self therapy, and being able to just be free, where as the other world me, I can get nervous talking in front of people, I can be self-conscious, I can be introverted, and Woodhead doesn't give a damn. He's like, he just wants to be free. And I studied children when I was putting my character together, creating my character. I just watched the way they moved and how much freedom they had. It's like, wow, this is it. This is, I'm going to have fun doing it. We'll see where it goes. So
you were apparently part of a musical group called the Holcomb Brothers, and you had a musical act as well. Yes. Am I correct about that?
I still have the Holcomb Brothers, as far as I know.
Okay.
I have a wonderful band I play with, and I get to be the front man and the singer, and that's sort of kind of a childhood fantasy. And I work with some really, really fun musicians. So playing music collaboratively is a hoot. And we love our harmonies. I work with a Broadway singer, he was a Broadway singer, Alan Nichols. He was in the original cast of Hair and Jesus Christ Superstar, and did the Sgt. Pepper, the Beatle touring show. And
wow.
So he and I love singing together, and I love harmonies. You know, I heard the Beatles, and I was sold on whatever sound they have, and that is something special. So yeah, the band is still happening. We do Tanglewood every 4th of July, and it's the James Taylor concert, and do stuff in New York State and Vermont State. And yeah, that's another cog in the wheel. Living in Vermont, you gotta wear those hats, you know.
You have and you said that a couple of times, and I really admire you for the amount of hats that you wear. I mean, again, when I was doing the research, I just kept looking at the videos and the clips and things and saying this man has so many different skills. It must be exhausting to have to kind of keep up all of those skills at the same time so you can continue to tour and make a living and do these gigs.
You have to be resilient too. You have to jump on the train that's going by at the time. And I just had a meeting with the Circus Murcus executive director this morning, and a woman by the name of Rachel Schiffer, who in Vermont, we've got a lot of really, really amazing people. You know, it's a gorgeous state, and it's actually more the faces than the places around Vermont that are, nature brought a lot of interesting people here. And there's a vibrant art scene, and we've got a lot of organizations like Circus Murcus that are teenage centric. But Very Merry Theater, which is a musical theater for teenagers, and we've got Big Heavy World, which nurtures teenagers and music, rock music. And we've got some very creative people that work in technology and coding. There's the Hack Club, which is an amazing group of young people that run this incredible nonprofit social club for teenagers. And they have a membership of somewhere over 25,000 teenagers around the world, and they're based in Vermont. And I get to work with these groups that are working with teenagers, which has been an amazing experience just over the last few years.
So tell me, you have a partner now. I believe his name is Rob. I don't know how to pronounce his last name. Rob Kreitz.
His name is Rob Kreitz.
Oh, Kreitz. Okay.
Yeah, and I'd never heard a name like that either. And when I met him, I told him, "What's with that name, man? Did you make that up, or what?" It's such an unusual name. Rob is a circus trained performer. He lived in California and Las Vegas the last 20 years, and he's a great, very skilled prop person, circus person, stilt walker, unicycles, dances. He's a great juggler. So I met him through a high wire walker I know by the name of Jade Kinder Martin, one of the world's best, who was a Circus Murcus performer, Vermonter. And we're putting together the first annual Vermont Circus Festival. And because Vermont has such a rich tradition and history and youth circus, it just seemed like a natural. And there's there's so much resource and so many Circus Murcus alumni in Vermont. And anyway, we've been working on this idea, and he introduced me to Rob Kreitz. He says there's a friend of mine I've met through the years who's he's a Cirque du Soleil performer and did a lot of Disney stuff. He toured with Paul McCartney. He's and he's a great guy. You two will hit it off. You'll like him. So he introduced me to Rob, and I met Rob, and he's got a mohawk, and he's got an 8-year-old, and he's kind of like an Oliver Hardy at Spirit. He's a very jovial personality. And unlike my first partner, Waldo, wonderful guy, but he and I, we had a magic on stage, but we didn't have an offstage chemistry. So it was difficult for us. We were so different. And it made for sparks and chemistry on stage like nothing else I had ever experienced. And but Rob has this, he and I can talk about anything. You know, he's the kind of guy, before you go out on stage, you say, love you, brother, have fun. And that's the whole sort of impetus. We're going to go have fun. We're going to do what we know how to do. We've been around this block a number of times. We can do this. These people are there. You know, we go through our little, let's just go have fun, and they're going to enjoy watching whatever we do, even if it's a silent meditation for 75 minutes. This, whatever we do, that's the goal. It's to transform this audience, open up their chakra, and, you know, give them some comedy and love, and see, and be honest with them. And we plug into these characters, and we have an outline of the show, but we don't necessarily know what's going to happen, because it's all in the moment. And when you've got an audience out there, you've got a lot of different energy and a lot of combustion and great ingredients, and the amalgam that happens with all of us in that room, you know, that's something we want to go to that place together. So the audience is willing, we know that. And so you get into this headspace where you're determined to have fun. You know, that's the goal. And, you know, dang, it usually works. You know, it's like, even if you have to apologize or ask them not to throw so many tomato, you know, whatever, it always works if you're real with your audience, even if you're disguised as someone else. I'm looking forward to coming back to that area. The Chautauqua tour back in the day was something I'm trying to emulate now in Vermont, doing a town-to-town tour of vaudevillians and thinkers and innovators and healers, and going from town to town like Chautauqua used to, and getting the public out on the village green and the town square, wherever, and putting on a show and an informative afternoon for family audiences. It's a really fantastic place on earth over there. Not unlike, you know, where I live. It's really important. It's a creative place over there, and I have fond memories.
Well, great. I'm glad to hear of all the projects you're doing, especially that town to town one. Really nice. And as I said, I think the audiences are going to enjoy having you back and watching your particular brand of theatrical vaudevillian madcap madness. Woody, thanks for stopping by. Thanks for giving me all the time and the stories that you gave me. I think it's been wonderful talking to you.
Tom, thank you for what you're doing. And I enjoyed spending this time with you. So take care.
Okay. Take care, Woody.
Lots of love. Bye.
Mr. Kreitz and Woodhead, Sons of Vaudeville and Masters of Mayhem, will be performing in the Marvel Theater at SUNY Fredonia with two shows, one at 2 p.m. and another at 7 p.m. on Saturday, November 4th, 2023. Tickets can be obtained by calling the campus box office at 716-673-3501 or by going online at www.fredonia.edu/tickets. It's sure to be an entertaining show. And that's it for this spooktacular edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat. My thanks to Robert Strauss, Alberto Rey, and Woody Keppel for being my guests on this episode. Notes from the Aisle Seat is a production of the 1891 Fredonia Opera House in Fredonia, New York. For more information on any of the Opera House's events, call the box office at 716-679-1891, visit the website at www.fredopera.org, or email at operahouse@fredopera.org. Notes from the Aisle Seat is now available wherever you get your podcasts and also on the Opera House YouTube channel. If you like this podcast, please consider following us by clicking the follow button on our home website at aisleseat.podbean.com and spreading the word through your social media feeds. If you have an arts event you'd like featured on this podcast, why don't you drop us a line at operahouse@fredopera.org and we'll see about featuring your event. Please try to give us a month's advance notice, if possible, to facilitate timely scheduling. If you have any suggestions, comments, or criticisms of the podcast, just drop us a line at operahouse@fredopera.org. We'll be glad to receive your feedback. Our next episode will be available on Wednesday, November 8th, 2023. I'm Tom Laughlin, and until then, be safe out there and be kind to one another.